Winter Sojourn Group of 1990 is presenting this book discussion. And the discussion is on a woman's reality. And so for all of you here who are not sojourners, that's what we're doing. Let me ask a question. You can see I have male, female here. I'm not going to add up scores here. I'm just going to. One of the questions that that we wrote down, a couple of questions that we were interested in finding out, and then we'll go into the discussion of the book. These are not right or wrong answers, so you know, don't get worked up about it or anything. But what are some of the advantages that people can think of being male, and what are some of the advantages of being a female that people can think of in this society in the 20th century here?
Don't make judgment calls on my answer for a long
time. Let's start with the advantages first, and then when we run out of advantages, we'll say disadvantages. We need to make it.
Be precise.
All right, Q, female endurance.
Oh, let me explain something here. I can't spell. So, all right. You don't judge my spelling, I won't judge your answers, okay? What else?
I think there's some instant. I think also under female would be maternity leave.
Depends on where you are. Yeah. I don't think McDonald's does maternity leave.
I don't know if any young people get male maternity leave. But
that's what I mean.
Paternity leave.
For men, an advantage is that this is still really a patriarchal society, and so positions of power are still much more readily accessible by men, as in politics or positions of leadership.
How do I write that down?
Power structure.
Political power.
Political power?
Much easier access to political power, decision making power.
Yeah, just access to power.
Yeah.
Just power.
Just power.
I think that males have much less emphasis given to their looks, be it from each other or from emphasis women give them or from advertising. Yeah, I think there's much less stress put on them to be physically a certain way.
That applies also to aging. It's more respectable for a male than just for female.
Yeah, it's an advantage for male role. Mm-hmm.
Alana, was that thing you read today about the time a male puts in on personal grooming? Yeah. Isn't it like 15 minutes?
15 minutes a day.
And then did it give anything about women?
No, it didn't.
Okay.
It didn't. It was in the, what's that called? The Harper's Index. and it said that the average American male spends 15 minutes a day for personal grooming.
That includes a shower.
I guess that includes the whole works.
Everything.
Everything.
This is outside of the male.
So Thomas.
This is probably part of the power business with the good old boy network.
Totally. Especially on camping trips.
There you go. This is practice.
So is the advantage the peen or is the advantage the penis? Where's the advantage?
It's an advantage you can aim where you pee.
Aim it.
It's as simple as that.
Are you standing up or is it that it's portable? No,
aim where you pee. Just simply that.
External drain tube.
spoken as a doctor.
I just write them down.
I think an advantage for the female is that she can choose if she, to be a housewife, a homemaker, stay at home, with a lot less criticism than I understand now some of the males are being the house.
It's true.
House parent.
Women can receive comfort easier than people.
Receive comfort? Have I misspelled anything?
Yeah.
Never mind.
You went?
I was going to write something, but I forgot what it was. Write something.
Question mark.
I think our educational patterns as we progress, not so much in primary school, but in secondary school and college, patterns of education favor patterns of that are more male than female. Now, whether those things are culturally inculcated or whether they're biological, I don't know. But linear thought is more typical of males than of females, who are more contextual, and that's what's required by our education system. I got about that roundabout way.
Yeah, you're going there.
That's real contextual there.
Okay, this is going to sound... I'll put it down because I believe it, and then you can jump on me at another time.
Can't read it.
It says, can blame men. I think women can blame men more for stuff. Women can say, if women get in a bad relationship that doesn't work out, women can say, he used me, or he, I mean, it's more acceptable for women to blame men than for men to blame women, I think. If men start blaming women, someone will call them a wimp real quick.
So it's an advantage to be a victim.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think women use being a victim if they're victims more often, but I don't know, never mind, just don't judge it. That's what I said, so. Would disadvantages be some of the same stuff, just switched around?
Yes.
Pretty much. So there's no point in doing disadvantages?
Well, for me, one disadvantage being female is worrying about being physically attacked. Okay. That we have to worry about being raped or...
And that's the corollary with the size and strength.
Actually, just always draw lines across.
Right. You know, like permission for feeling is a disadvantage for the male.
Yeah, I think it's still life expectancy. Think about specific
examples. Okay. Just the best thing. Share that?
Oh, no.
The disadvantage for him is not being able to spell and having to stand at the board. My advantage is I can spell and I'm sitting here watching and not spelling.
We thought it would look better. I wrote. You get visions of Vanna White with her. You get visions of I don't have a game show. Yeah, I guess we could crisscross. What if we ask the question... well, even if we ask the question, what would you like about being female? If you were male, let's ask the males first. What would they like about being female? Would they like all of this?
Not childbirth.
Not childbirth. Oh,
come on,
yeah.
Now, what's the question?
I don't blame you. I wouldn't either.
What
would men like about being a woman? Is there anything a men would like about being
from,
yeah,
from this list? I would like the permission for feeling and also life expectancy, less competition,
ability for close friendships,
receive comfort,
the option to be a homemaker.
I guess that's all of them.
I think this childbirth issue is really kind of interesting. How many of you men would like to have a baby if you had the option?
Yeah.
It's pretty exciting.
It's not here.
Oh, come on. You need calls for us.
I guess the reason I asked
why that, I did Crawford, I felt completely out of it.
I asked that for, and I'll just put it in here, and you can think about it or not, I guess. But one of the things I find interesting about that, that men aren't excited about that, is so much power and the struggle has to do with the ability to give birth, I think, in societies, various societies, that women are sent out to have their periods or their, I mean, anything that relates to the process of birthing. So I wasn't supposed to have my side.
Well, it is interesting when you think of the of modern day America, and I'm talking about the last 40 years, when you think of the struggle that's gone on with birth and birthing, medically and sociologically, if men don't want to be giving birth, they sure are interested in getting in there and interfering in any possible way as physicians.
It's a money-making venture.
Well, this is true, but I mean, that's just, it just struck me that that's interesting. They kind of can't keep their hands off. Mm-hmm. Well,
but
even the whole issue.
I would like to say that I think it's very encouraging to see that the movement to change the way obstetrics is practiced has come from the grassroots, has come from the women, and then they have, by women making choices, for example, to go to nurse midwives or to go to physicians that offer a less interventional practice, and I mean, that has swept through the entire country now. And so that, you know, the hospitals are now advertising your birthing rooms and they've turned the whole thing around.
Well, that sort
of
leads us
back to the way it has always been for centuries before. I mean, this is just a very small period of time where
aberration.
Yeah. Where the, excuse me.
Well, that sort of leads us into the book. is there anyone here who doesn't know what this book's about?
Beyond the title. You know?
Beyond the title itself.
I read Think with Contents.
Okay. This book you can see it's called Woman's Reality. But basically what it's about is that her premise is that there is a white male system in this country that dictates everything. It is the dominant system in this country. Is there someone that doesn't know what I mean by white male system? Okay, so we understand that, right?
Would they say?
What?
Yeah, would they, maybe you should just go ahead and, yeah.
Okay, the premise of this book is that the white male system, which is basically everything in America that connotates power, respect, know-how, intelligence, everything positive centers around being a white male. Either you are a white male or you learn how to act like a white male in order to fit into the system. If you do not act like a white male, if you do not participate in the white male system, then there are strong disadvantages. Money's one, power's one, respect's one, the whole thing. To the extent that it can lead to physical ailments, it could lead to humiliation publicly, and in some cases it can even lead to death, i.e. assassinations of all sorts. And that's the premise of her book, and that's what we'll be hopefully discussing here tonight, is that is for those of you who don't know, you get an explanation of what the white male system is and how it either affects you or affects you negatively or affects you positively, and how we all, one way or another, are affected by this system, how we either struggle to fit in or struggle to keep it from overtaking us or destroying us, and how it permeates every single aspect of American life. So on that note, I'll sit down and we can proceed to discuss.
I think there's something else that's pretty important that's a part of what Verlon just presented, and that's that at the very heart of that system is the assumption that women are inferior, or I shouldn't just say women, anyone that is not a white male is inferior, and if you're a white male, you are superior. So that how women and people of color in general try and fit themselves into that system is to gain superiority or be given validation by the white male system that you are okay. I just think that's really important in terms of what she says, to know that we're talking about levels of hierarchy there and understanding of self.
Is there anyone here who doesn't think this is true? We're not saying it's true. I mean, we're saying it's in the book. Is there somebody here who has, you know, who wants more clarification or who is in doubt or any such thing?
Or who would want to clarify what we just said? I mean, there's lots of footnotes that come to mind as we were discussing as a group today, and a question came up about this whole issue of inferiority, superiority. I talked a bit about what it means to be in a Judeo-Christian faith that basically describes women having been given their being out of man, Adam. That women would not have existed as it's described. I mean, women, feminist theologians have a different interpretation of Adam than our Adam presentation, Adam being earth. But for us, we understand Adam is man, and it is the rib from which we were created. Had there not been an Adam, we don't know, I suppose. And that is a part of.
So you're sitting there looking at us. Are we not presenting this well? I don't know.
Do you want us to what happens next?
Are the Sojourn people going to talk about certain?
No, the Sojourn people are just here.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I have a comment that relates to the power on the male side and basically homemakers and childbirth and the more feminine issues on the women's side. And it also relates to the whole power structure, the white male supremacist, you know, system that we're talking about. And that is that in this country, as in most of Western civilization, it's the men who are making the decisions about reproductive issues for women. It's the men who are making decisions that have to do for example, with maternity leave, and it's the men who are making decisions that have to do with displaced homemaker programs. It's the men who are making decisions that have to do with birth control and its availability. That seems really out of balance, and yet, I think the fact that Catherine, you know, kind of pointed to the childbirth issue is really important, because for whatever reason, that seems to be an area that men feel a real need to be in control. I mean, maybe it's because it seems like one area that women have power that they don't. You know, I don't know why that is. But that troubles me a lot about the system, that issues that are really particularly feminine are areas that the male system is making lots and lots of decisions about.
Well, give me some examples. Well, not examples, but I guess I don't understand that. There are more women than men. Did women just give this responsibility up? Did
men take it? Men, yeah.
I don't understand. I mean, there was a time when women had a baby, they sent the men out, and the man stood out in the field or sat out in the other room or something, and the woman had the baby with another woman.
But those were pre-birth control days when there were not policy decisions that needed to be made, because when birth control was first introduced into this country, it was in about 1919, and Margaret Sanger had been in Northern Europe and discovered that the Dutch were using what we now call the diaphragm. She called it a pessary, and she brought it back and opened her first birth control clinic after having been a social worker watching numerous women of poverty die in childbirth or die because of illegal abortions because they had so many kids they couldn't feed what they already had. And so they were trying to abort themselves. And so she opened a birth control clinic and was distributing these diaphragms that were already readily available in Europe. And she was jailed numerous times by the male system because what she was doing was, in quotes, against the law, which...
And religion.
Yeah, which the men had written.
I think the irony of that is a couple of things. When you think about it, the women are the ones who are supposed to be responsible for not getting pregnant. I mean, the only reason condoms are being used now is because we're talking about safe sex, right? And yet, in hiring practices, there's this either verbalized or non-verbalized fear that if you hire a woman, she may get pregnant and have to leave. And so the women aren't hired. So we're said to have control over and the responsibility of, but obviously not responsible enough to. Yeah, I mean, that those two things are in conflict, and how can you possibly?
I think part of it is your worldview, that business must go on. I mean, as businesses of whatever kind they are set up today, it is a big hassle to be out somebody for several months. But if we were a little less anxious about that, maybe we'd be able to get into the celebration of, oh, one of our coworkers has a new child, and embrace that. But the profit margin has to be kept going, or whatever it is, and it's very hard to slow down for that. So really the business mindset has to change for that.
Which is the linear mind that Jan was talking about, that sees all the profit figures.
Verlaine, maybe to address your question again, I think it goes further back, though, than just when birth control came into existence. I don't know any dates, but when midwives, when it was a practice that women were delivering the babies, and that it was involving just females, there came a point when the males, started declaring these women heretical or witches or possessing powers that were not of God and were executing them. And then that's how they stepped into the power and the power position of being these doctors. And they're the ones that came up with the forceps that were used to deliver the babies, as opposed to the midwives who were used to using their hands for helping to deliver. They started making instruments that were killing babies.
But they were also saving a lot of babies' lives, and I'm not
willing to. Well, this is the perspective that I read in Of Woman Born by Vivian Rich.
But I don't. I have to say I don't necessarily agree with that there wasn't some. I don't know what I want to say. I want to say that the impetus to design the forceps came from trying to save children's lives, not necessarily to cause harm to women.
Okay, then I didn't convey that sentiment correctly. I guess what I was getting at was that they saw the women as having powers they shouldn't, and that's why they moved into that position.
Let me further along this discussion. I got some stuff here. It says that there are a few white men who do not fit into this white male system. Of course, at this point in history, that group is largely homosexual. Another part here is, there's a direct correlation between buying into the white male system and surviving in our culture. Since white women have bought into the system the most, they have survived better than other groups, both economically and physically, although they do not get battered and raped and mutilated, for example, through unnecessary surgery, they have had to hide and or unlearn their system and accept the stereotypes that the white male system has set up for them. Is there any response to
Could you read that again?
Yeah.
That was like, gee.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, it was a real heavy.
There's a direct correlation between buying into the white male system and surviving in our culture. Since white women have bought into the system the most, they have survived better than other groups, both economically and physically, although they do not get battered and raped and mutilated. For example, although they do get battered and raped and mutilated, for example, through unnecessary surgery, they have had to hide and or unlearn their own system and accept the stereotypes that the white male system has set up for them.
I don't know if it's so much a necessarily a thing of conformity. I mean, a black person is not allowed into the white male system, period. It's nothing that they really have a lot of control over, just because of the virtue of the fact they're black, or any other random other.
I guess I would disagree with that, because I think the white male system has a lot. It definitely has to do with, you know, your physical makeup, whether you're male, whether you're white. But I also think that acceptance into the white male system does directly involve how well do you play a stereotype that is established by and within that system. In fact, I think it's a good distinction that I would like to ask that people make this distinction when they're referring to the white male system, that they refer to it in that way rather than saying the men. Because I think there's a lot of participants in the white male system and its dominance who are women and who are also black.
The part about survival is not just metaphorical. In fact, I was reading this morning again statistics of the incidence of high blood pressure, stroke, heart attacks, diabetes in the black population, and the genetics aside, the incidence of those diseases is just sky high compared to the white population, as is infant mortality. And I think that that really our physical survival is impacted by being an outlier for generations, or even just your own generation. That we're not just talking about, oh, it's really sad that a lot of women or black people can't be bank presidents. That's, you know, really a too bad thing. We're talking about people not living as long as I think God intended people to live. In fact, now as I yak a little bit, the statistic was that if you can play with numbers, probably a third of all the black people who die this year died prematurely.
A third of all those people, should, if they were white, they probably wouldn't have died. And that's, it echoes some of the things that you said tonight, Robert. I mean, you look around and people are dying right now because of an institution, a social system. And I had never really put physical survival with that.
Well, one of the things, I lived in D.C. for 6 years, and for those of you who do not know, D.C. has right now the highest murder rate of any city in the nation. And the last time I was there, the last year I was there, 535 people were killed in D.C., murdered in a year. Now, granted, 80% of those murders were drug-related. But the reality is that any time 575 young white men were killed, if that happened in any major city in the U.S., anywhere in the U.S., you can bet that something would be done about it. Either put the whole city on a curfew or whatever else, you know. But the reality is that they're black men and they're expendable. In the white male system, everybody is expendable except the white males and those who buy into the white male system, who learn how to use it.
I guess I have a little bit of trouble with the word everybody. I think it tends to be tendencies, because in Portland, they just made a very good conviction on Metzger and the Aryan White Nations who had incited a murder against a black man. So I think that your point is well taken, in the sense that in general, murders of black people tend to be more expendable than murders of white people. But I wouldn't call it so black and white as to say that every black murder is an expendable murder, and every white murder is one that you have to bring out the Constitution for to make sure the justice is done.
Well, I don't want to get into a racial discussion. We're a feminist one, but I think that it's so minuscule, the fact that the government comes to, and the system comes to the front on something like that. I'm not sure if it's even worth mentioning. I mean, one person has brought to justice out of how many thousands of black men are killed, a year. And my favorite example is that the Black Panthers were wiped out in about 7 years. The Black Panthers never hung anybody. You know, the Black Panthers never physically took to the streets and did anything to anybody. But the KKK terrorist group has been around since late 1800s. And you see what I'm saying? I mean, I honestly feel it's minuscule, but that's another topic.
What you said a moment ago struck a bell with me, and I don't know if this connects or not. Maybe others can comment on it. But I was appalled a few years ago, and I haven't been kept up now with what's happened in Panama and other places since. But when Reagan finally decided to act over the Gaddafi thing, it was not because women and children had been attacked or civilians had been attacked. It wasn't until there were a couple of deaths of soldiers in Germany, bombing in a brothel of all things, I think, that he finally asked, this is going too far, you killed some of our soldiers, you know. And what you said a moment ago about the only thing that's not expendable is these white males, and I just wonder if there's some connection there with our militarism.
I think that and the legal system in general, when you think about women who have been raped and beaten, whatever, that they're the ones who are put on trial, not the man
who is the perpetrator, but they themselves. And it's their lives that are put on. I mean, some things have changed, but then you hear about judges in Florida who say, yeah, but you know, she was wearing a skimpy outfit. And you just, things fly open again, and you realize. Or that, what's her name, that just won out in Texas, the guy that she was running against. What was the guy's name she was running against? Pardon?
Clayton Williams.
Who, sitting around a campfire, jokingly said, getting raped is like rain. Women should just sit back and enjoy it. You know, and who supported him? The women. Not just Bush, but women there were justifying that he said that. So what does that say? You know, your point is well taken, John. I think in terms of a white male system, it's a white male system that has women saying, that's okay to say that other women should accept a comment like that, flippant or non, least of all by someone who's in a gubernatorial race.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people say, you know, why aren't women doing something about this? But it's like, if you do, what are you up against? There's one section in here. Many women simply do not know how to live without playing these destructive games. Since we grow up in a foreign culture, a white male system which is always defined as right, we tend not to trust our own perceptions. Whenever we have different perceptions, whenever we try to explore other realities, we are told we are sick, bad, crazy, stupid, ugly, or incompetent. I have yet to meet a woman who has not acknowledged her own particular fear of being sick, bad, crazy, stupid, etc. We do this rather than feeding our own healthy perceptions. When someone implies that we are off the wall or just do not understand how things are, most of us, unless we have successfully confronted our caverns, will back off from our own perceptions and visibly demonstrate how we see things just the way everybody else does. I mean, that for me is, you know, it's like if you do think that things are screwed up, what does that mean, you know, if you say or try and do something about it? I know what that means for me at work. Plus, I'm viewed as the castrating bitch and ball-busting man-hater who must be a lesbian. I mean, it's like people have to put some kind of label on me because I don't necessarily agree with the structure, the way things are. So, you know, a lot of times it's easier just to keep your mouth shut than to talk about how you perceive things. So, you know, sometimes I do that. Or
I think the prospect for change is incredibly difficult for any person to do alone, whether they be a man or a woman, because I think there are equivalent repercussions and penalties for a man to attempt to change, even in a small way, something that is a little more uniform, something that is a little less skewed towards male dominance, because men can also be viewed as pansies, can be viewed as homosexuals, for similar kinds of responses. I think probably the places where I have seen the most progress being done to look for better equity and really countering some of the effects of the white male system are where men and women have joined in solidarity to address one specific issue, whether it be in one company addressing having maternity leave, or whether it be having within one company having their own affirmative action program that is self-policing. Those are the effects that I've, at least that I have seen, to be the most positive. People who tend to do it alone are labeled, I think, just as you say. almost regardless of the kind of support around them. It seems like when there are people who are operating together within a given context for a given cause, that there tends to be some real progress made.
You make a good point in the sense that everybody who tries to get out of the white male system is punished. Mm-hmm. White males also, if white males try to step out of the system and function in another way, are punished. And I've noticed with people I went to school with, it's just as difficult for white males to get out of the system as it is for me to get in. People are always telling them things like, why don't you do this, why don't you do that? Literally shoving opportunities at them because that system needs white males, you know. To the extent that many white males I know basically just show up and things work. You know, in the sense of they can plug into a system and just wait for other people to die or retire or whatever and just, you know, move on up. Nobody in this country has those advantages but white males. But if a white male decides, hey, I'm checking out, it's too much for me, I can't do it or something like that, it's pretty impossible to do.
I have a couple of comments that have sort of, and I hope I can get this out articulately, but in looking at the continuum from when men and women started as, you know, cavemen and women, it was the man's size and strength that gave him the power. And as I see it, as we sit here in 1990, I wonder what kind of form, or whether this would even be an issue, say, in the year 2040, if we're able to save the globe. But as I see a lot of really encouraging things that are happening in terms of male-female equality and stuff, and in just in a very short period of time. For example, a number of women when I was in medical school was like 10% of our class or less, and would be how many in your class? What percentage?
A third.
That's a change. We're seeing more women. We see a greater interest in cooking. These are just some examples I'm throwing out. So I think that's really encouraging. And the fact that now in where we're living now, the size and the strength is no longer a factor because we have so many machines that do the physical work for us. John was saying, companies that are looking at things in a more equal manner, for example, giving paternity and maternity leave and celebrating, as Libby said, the birth of the child of a coworker. I'm very interested in the concept of sabbaticals, and when Verlon was referring to what happens to a white male as part of a system that tries to leave the system, even temporarily, the responses I had from my colleagues were pretty incredible. And it was almost like there was some denial, there was some like, you're really not doing what you're, why are you doing this, you know? And so I'm an outlier to the system. My medical society, for example, didn't even acknowledge that I'm gone, you know? And most of my colleagues in my immediate medical staff responded with anger. You know, how could you do this? The whole thing, but it's changing. And so a lot of the things that we're talking about now are problems, but hopefully, at least in my vision in the future, they will not be quite so much of a problem.
I don't have a perspective on the future. I just have this sense of knowing that I should be something, that I should be trained to be something, that I should have a career, that I should do that, that I should also be a wife and a mom. So I get this double thing where you get to be something, you get to come home and you get to do everything else you didn't do while you were doing something else. And I don't have any perspective that what I guess what I'm saying is that I don't see it improving. I have the burden of the freedom to do what I want in addition to what I should be doing.
That's now. Maybe in the future that won't be.
How would that change? How will that change? I mean, time is neutral. Time isn't going to do it.
I would hope that when men and women, they were talking about a white male system, when the white male system, quote unquote, ceases to be in existence, because there will be more women involved in everything, so that the system will erode, and that there will be more equality between men and women, so that if a woman, the young girls that are growing up now won't have that double burden that your generation is experiencing, the superwoman and so on and so forth. Because it won't be, you know, they will have a choice. They can make a choice. They can, if they decide to have a family, they can have a family and be a mom until the kids are raised. Or if they don't want to have children, they
well, but I, you know, what Desilie's saying really resonates with me too, because that's a choice now that women have. But the reality is that if you make one choice, which is to be home and raise your kids, who are really tomorrow's citizens, and is probably much more productive work than, you know, pushing pieces of paper around on a desk for 8 hours a day, we're still really devalued. And I know that when I got my graduate degree and then worked after that, and then I quit as soon as Brendan was born, and we would be in some kind of a social gathering, people would say, well, what do you do? That's always the question people ask. Well, what do you do? Oh, I'm a full-time mom. Oh, and the response you get is, there's got to be somebody more interesting here to talk to. I need to go find them. And you lose your identity. 2 years ago, when I started doing consulting social work again in our little town, and we would again go to gatherings, I was the same person, these were the same people I've been associating with. But now was, well, how is it now that you're working again? You know, tell me about your work in hospice. And so our identities are really tied up in what we do, and I see that as part of the male system, but also just part of our capitalistic system, and the whole emphasis on production and productivity and having something to show. Having healthy, well-adjusted kids doesn't seem to be an adequate, you know, show for our efforts.
And maybe they turn out healthy and well-adjusted.
John, can you? Oh, I was just going to say a couple things. There was a movie that we watched last March, February, and it was done by National Association of Women, I think, or something like that, National Organization of Women. It was about the history of women in the 20th century, and what came out of that movie most strongly was how there was such a seesaw effect between gains and losses for women. Say for example, in the 20s, women were very independent. Birth control was becoming more available. Women started getting office jobs, etc., which had previously only been an area which men had any luck getting placed in. But then the 30s came along and there was a depression, so women went back to being moms. Then the 40s came along and there was World War II and they needed women to work in the factories. So women went out again and got jobs and doing really well. But then the war ended, so they went back to being super moms. Then the 60s came along and etc., etc. So what I would say is, yes, they're making gains, but it's slow, and you've also got to be very careful about how it's going to flip-flop. There's a book in the bookstore, which I haven't read yet, but it's called The Handmaid's Tale. Mm-hmm. And,
knock your socks off,
dude. I wouldn't be surprised.
It's a pretty incredible book. Yeah.
I think it's also... it's not just having more women in these different roles in society, it's changing the structure and making the white male system not a white male system, but a human system that incorporates everyone in a reality instead of saying that this is a reality. And that change is what you have to figure out. How does that happen? But just moving people into being doctors isn't
doing. I disagree, because I think the more women that are in there, the more effect they're going to have on changing a specific area.
But not, they're just trying to be the same as Libby's trying to be just like you.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
To do it. I mean,
it
as we said a few minutes ago, the white male system is not just made up of white males.
Yeah.
And we talked about an advantage for women in talking about feelings, so I'm going to take hold of that advantage. How angry I was, John, when I heard you describing people working together, because this was my experience, and I'll own that. I heard more than you said. I heard a lot of history. Let's just all be reasonable and sit down and we'll work this thing out. What does that do with the years of frustration and anger that has been pent up with men and women who haven't gotten to be a part of that system? That's what's got to be, there's got to be some room for us to acknowledge our rage for being told that you should be that way when you're a little kid, when you're a college student, when you're a graduate student. And then maybe I'll think about being reasonable, but I think that the biggest damage done to people of any size or shape is to be told to be reasonable when you're not feeling reasonable. And that has to do with the change of heart and becoming new people together. And
we talked about that this morning in Sojourn, about how white males have not acknowledged the damage that the system has done to women and people of color. Robert Bly talks about the fact that we never ever mourn Vietnam. That, you know, the only people who have mourned Vietnam have been the vets, and we drag them out on Memorial Day, you know, and watch them mourn, and that's it. But that the society as a whole, the president as a whole, there's several articles and maybe even a book out now talking about the denial, that Ronald Reagan's in denial, that his father was an alcoholic and he's a ACOA and they connected to the 12-step thing and all of that. But there's some truth to the fact that this society, the white male system, has never ever acknowledged the damage of racism, has never ever acknowledged the damage of Vietnam, or how it's treated women, or the fact that, you know, the country was taken and built, the economy was based on the backs of slaves, the country was taken from Natives Americans, and just there's a whole bunch of stuff out there that nobody has touched, you know, mourned.
Sheikh talks about the rage and in a section she calls Dealing with Rage. It is no secret that women in general are very, very angry. Nobody likes to be innately inferior. Blacks do not like it. Chicanos do not like it. Women do not like it. And then she goes into a list of things that happen to women as a part of, well, what she says is, we may then begin to question the culture that taught us that attaching ourselves to a male absolves us of our original sin of being born female. This becomes another source of rage. And then she lists what we do. Super competent women, seductress, ultra feminine, chemically dependent, depressed, neighborhood gossip, getting fat. The whole list of things that we do to internalize that rage. Because, and then she says, what results of all this is the creation of a vicious cycle. We direct our rage toward our partners and our children, and then try to turn and become angry with us, which only makes us angrier. you know, that we internalize that or we take it out on someone else and then it's my fault, obviously I'm innately inferior, and the system continues. Now I think your comment about, it also fits when you were talking about the number of black men that are killed in D.C. in a year. And you said, granted that it's drug related, and then went on, I thought, no, not granted that it's drug related, because the fact that it's, you know, that whole system puts people into an inferior position, and so you find what you can, whether it's drugs or it's something else, to try and be out of that. So that, to me, is also part of that whole system.
Jonathan,
maybe this is too big a question to ask, but I'll do it anyway. And that is, I don't know what to do with your anger and your anger. I got blasted a couple times in college, pretty severely, for sort of an attitude that made you angry. Well, you know, I know this goes on, and I want to know what to do about it. And I think people that, or maybe men that say that, I think a lot of them do really feel that way. They want to change, but there's so much anger there that either get blasted or there's not a connection made, or nothing positive eventually comes out of it. You know, I end up getting hurt whether it's justified or not. The women don't get anywhere except kind of churning the rage around, which I don't think is productive.
There's a big difference between anger and rage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anger is clear, straight, honest. Rage hurts people.
I don't think most... Okay, then
and
I would
hard,
say...
It's hard to walk
right.
That line.
And I would say most people in general would probably respond with rage rather than anger. Because I would say most people aren't really sure what they're angry at. They don't know what to go at, and so it just ends up spilling over and white and damaging a whole bunch of things. But, so what do we do?
Well, one thing that a group of men in St. Cloud are doing is they have a group that's part of a national organization called Brother Peace, where they're saying that, you know, we're going to have to take responsibility for stopping violence against women. And they do things like camping in a local park where it's dangerous for women to walk where they've been raped. So they camp out there so it's safe for women to walk through. They pass out literature. They talk with people who come through. And they're saying basically that men don't listen to women. So men have to start talking to other men and saying, we're not going to do this anymore, shape up. And they have parades, they march through the street and beat a drum like every 13 seconds to symbolize how often a woman is beaten in the United States, those types of things. It's a real small group. I mean, the St. Cloud area is 60,000 people, and they're like 8 or 10 men. And they're ridiculed, you know, people think they're a bunch of wackos. But they're saying, we're going to have to do something, you know, ourselves.
I think something, the book talks about how the white male system doesn't acknowledge the differences and doesn't really try to work with that. They just say, oh, let's just look at what's the same and get on with it. And I think what you have to do personally is be willing to let somebody get angry maybe and not take it personally. Realize that it's coming from way back, whatever kinds of things, and really listen to that and maybe not understand it, but then if you're really talking to someone, say, you know, I can tell that you're angry and I don't get it at all. Can you help me understand that so that I can get to where you are and then we can go from there together?
I think that's a lot easier said than done. I think if you're attacked, you're going to be defensive. You're not going to say, "Oh, you're angry. Let me understand what you're angry about." I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I think that's true. But I just
nobody said it was going to be an easy process.
Yeah.
Well, the thing about it is that I think men have to put themselves. White men have to put themselves into situations where they can be hurt, where they're not in charge. Whenever you're not in charge, you get hurt. And white men will not allow themselves to be anywhere where they're not in charge, where they're not taking orders from another white man, where they can't go in a room and slap each other on the back and laugh and eventually, you know. That's one thing, to put yourself in a position where you're not in charge, where you're not in the majority, to take a step out on faith, to do something risky like the eight men, to do something that other men may point at you and say, you know, that's ridiculous. Why are you doing that? You know, but to make that statement, to say that, you know, that I believe in this so much that I'm willing to stand out in the park at night to make sure that women aren't being raped. There has to be a sense of risk. I mean, you look at those, if ever you saw Eyes on the Prize and you see those black people being bit by dogs and you know, water hoses and all of that stuff being beat. I mean, there has to be some risk in there. If it's worth it for you, you have to put yourself in a position where you may not be top dog.
Scott had a comment. Linda had a comment. John has a comment. Jeannie has a comment. And just to let you know, if people want to, it's an hour and we're happy to stay. I'd be glad to stay on and continue. But if people, those who feel they need to leave, please do. Scott.
Well, I think this is an important conversation. I was just going to add another dimension to the discussion. Well, I do that. There's a group coming in February of men that around the issue of women. That's going to be the subject for it. It's going to be a men's only retreat. I think that's a fascinating kind of issue, because I think the patriarchal society or the white male society, when described, that survives and is maintained because of the wimpiness of men. So then the question is raised, how did men get to be wimps? Why is it that most men are not happy? The fact is, unless you're president of the corporation, and very few men are president of the corporation, most men are not happy doing what they're doing, or unless they're in business for themselves in some way. Most men are bored, most men feel in prison. Most men suffer all kinds of depressions and attempts to escape the realities of their own existence through affairs and booze and all kinds of things. Now, what created the wimpiness? And the suggestion is that what created the wimpiness, and this, I would predict this will be the next kind of series of books on this issue, which haven't been written yet, but that's what some call the underground matriarchy.
which consumes men. Men are raised largely by women in our society.
Hi.
And I think that's a fascinating issue that we have to begin to deal with in our society. I haven't begun to tease all that out for myself. I mean, I'm just beginning to think all of that, and I don't know quite how that relates. But I think it's a fascinating dimension of why the white male society continues to exist. Because men are not happy, by and large.
I just had two comments I wanted to make. One is that, and part of it relates to what Scott just said, and that is that my sense is that men also have a great deal of anger and also have a great deal of fear that functions as part of their lives. Fear of failure, fear of not meeting up to the system, fear of appearing to be a wimp within the system. Just fear that for a lot of men that's almost a primary motivation, and that's not a healthy way to be. And yet what I see is that it's a really small percentage of our society that are beginning to recognize these issues and really address them. And I wonder how long it's going to take for that to trickle down kind of through middle America and into the poor and into really the whole infrastructure of our society to create a whole cultural shift. And the other thought I was having is that we've talked about this only as an issue in Western civilization. And yet the reality is that women are dominated and oppressed, if you would, in most of the world. And in fact, Putney Reeder last year did a really wonderful issue on violence against women. And just for example, in Asian countries and in India, there's a very horribly high rate of infanticide of female children who are just literally taken to the garbage dump once they're born and it's seen that they're girls. There's also in India the practice that still continues at a fairly alarming rate of wife burning. There's a Hindu name for it because the woman's dowry isn't high enough. And so they're doused with gasoline or killed in other ways, and the society just shrugs as the Indian male then seeks another bride who has a higher dowry. The Putney Reeder indicated that, I mean, like a tiny percentage, like maybe 1 or 2% of those murders, in fact, were ever even charged against these men. So it's not just a white male system in America that we're talking about, I don't think. I think we're talking about a male-female system that's global and that has a lot of history behind it, thousands of years of history. I mean, even in the time of Christ and way before, we're talking about a system that was male dominant in most of the world. So how quickly we're going to be able to change that is a real puzzle to me.
Yeah. It's like things have gone in many different directions, but I do feel there's one thing that at least I need to ask and maybe express. I think two things really hit and hit me real personally. One, frankly, Scott, when you said fascinating, was something like this. In a way, it seems so easy to look at it in the clinical sense, because I think maybe personally, and this may relate more to near personal experience, was that it seems like it's less fascinating than it is either frightening or overwhelming, or sinks really deep into some of what I sense is awry in my own personal self and my own personal upbringing, and perhaps is archetypical in personal upbringing. So I guess when I hear it said as fascinating, I look at the intellectual side of myself that says, yeah, I kind of want to look at it that sterile, and I want to vomit. Because so much of it inside of me responds almost violently, realizing that there's something that relates to the way I was brought up by my mother that has made it such that whatever I see awry in the world, I want to fix. That makes it such that every time I'm confronted with a feeling that is directed towards me, I feel that I need to, that's going to have a personal front on me. All those things, I realize that recently I've been dealing with that, but I would wonder, I guess I hear it being called fascinating, and I sense that it's, it can't be extracted. I don't really mean to delve into science too much, but there is a fundamental law of physics that says any time you observe a system, by the very nature of observation, you change the nature of that system ever so slightly. And I think we as men, or we as people who are involved in that system, can hardly look at it clinically or detached, because I think we're very, very much a part of it. And the other thing too, maybe I'd ask this one of you, because I appreciate you responding with your anger in that way, and I mean that sincerely. But I guess the same response came through in me when I sensed that in you, was that my initial gut was to say, was I responsible for that, or how can I fix that and make it better? And I realized that I think that's part of the white male system of wanting to fix something that's wrong. I would like some clarification on this, and that is either women's anger or anybody's anger. What is it that is either needful or allowable with that anger from when I am in the presence of it? I don't mean is there an expected response, but is there, am I being expected to do something about it, or would it be best simply to allow it to be expressed and to observe it, acknowledge it, maybe not try to fix it and make it better, but simply to observe it and acknowledge it? Is that, to be honest with you, I'm real ignorant as to what to do in the face of that anger.
Well, I would need, this could be take a while, and I would really need other people to say what they heard. What I was trying to do was say, I'm angry. I wasn't saying I'm angry at you, or I think you're a wimp. What I heard made me angry. You happened to be the mouth that said it. I didn't want to hurt you, and I certainly didn't expect a change, a response, a fix it. I simply needed to say what I was feeling.
Right.
So I guess what I would ask from you is just to hear it.
And I think that, and I wanted to say kind of the same thing in response to Jonathan about what, I don't know what to do with your anger. I think it's really important, and while I understand the desire to want to fix it or to want to do something, you can't fix my anger. It's just there. And I'm the one who needs to work with my anger. What you can do is maybe not run away from me when I'm there, and look at what I'm angry about and find sources of your own anger. But you can't be angry for me or do my anger for me or take my anger away from me. And you can't fix it. You can be there with me, and you can find your own, and we can use that to move forward. And I really acknowledge and agree with Libby's distinction between rage and anger. You know, rage can be consuming, and rage, I think, is what a lot of us have because we don't know how to be angry. We don't know how to allow ourselves to be angry. But being angry and getting in touch with being angry is one of the most important things that we can do as humans, men and women, separately when we need to be separately angry, and together when we need to be angry together.
I think it would be somewhat helpful to take things out of the abstract and look at some of the issues going on locally at Holden. And one of the examples being the clear division that seems to be going on between basketball and volleyball, and you know, the camaraderie and the, you know, the idea that, that basketball is what the real men play, and you know, there's more of a chance to be aggressive, and you know, and volleyball is, you know, is a lesser thing. And you know, look at the issue of how was it decided that we were going to have a basketball court on the third level? Why isn't it a tennis court? You know, and this whole idea that as long as the men are still finding, you know, the camaraderie around the aggressive competitive sports, you know, I think that's part of what keeps things fueled and keeps things, the division there.
Catherine?
Yeah.
Back on the other issue too, is that I think it's important for us to recognize that the problems we're talking about tonight, none of us created. We inherited them. And we continue to participate in them. And why that seems significant to me is, I think this comes out of my own struggle with white racism. It was important for me at one point to realize that I did not, even though I participated in a white racist society and continue to do so, I did not create the problem. If I accept the responsibility for creating the problem, I think that just immobilizes me. Or I feel immobilized. The guilt becomes just more than I can deal with. And I remember when us, you know, white liberals used to get together, we'd invite our black friends to come out and beat on us about white racism. And I mean, they do that. And we get to feel guiltier and guiltier and guiltier, and we were just immobilized by that experience. And then somebody said, hey, you know, there's such a thing here as a new white person that says, yeah, I participate in this system, which is a white racist system. I didn't create the system, and I'm going to do what I can to begin to reshape that, reshape that system, but I'm not going to be immobilized by this guilt, because I didn't create the system. Those that went before me created the system that I have inherited for whatever reasons or however that's occurred. So I like what people have really said about not running away. I think Jeannie was talking about that, about us, you know, a white man like myself needs to be able to stand and listen and not run away and allow women to have their anger, which is legitimate and justified. But if I become immobilized by that, then I'm not going to do me any good, and I'm not going to do, ultimately, the cause any good. So I have to figure, well, how do I not become immobilized in the face of this huge problem that we have inherited?
That's a difficult one, I think, because, you know, at some level you have to bear that responsibility. You may not be the creator, but there is a sustainer as well. And each of us has to ask that question. You know, there's just so many emotions that are involved in that for me, and how I help to sustain that system as well by blaming myself if I'm not all the things that I should be.
Well, in the 60s, they used to say, black militants used to say, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And one way not to be part of the problem is that blacks say that white people are responsible. It's up to white people to do away with racism because it's not a black problem, it's a white problem. And I think it's the same way with sexism. It's not a female problem, it's a male problem. And if I can't stand up to men and say, I think that's sexist, or if I can't not participate in activities that I think are sexist, then I'm part of the problem. I'm perpetuating the problem. And even though I didn't create it, I certainly benefit from it, just like white people benefit from racism. And just like Deb said about those eight guys hanging around in the park and marching, that kind of thing, they're going out on a limb. You know, I'm sure they're being called all kinds of things, but they're not part of the problem anymore. You know, they're part of the solution. They're out there on a limb, they're taking a risk, but they're doing it because, you know, it's bigger than they are. They know they're not going to get rid of sexism, but at the same time, they're not immobilized. They're not sitting around stewing about it. It's an active thing.
I just have a couple comments. I'd like first to go back to the discussion where John started it and Libby responded and Jeannie responded. And John kind of expressed something that I had just become aware of in the last, probably the last 5 years. And the way I was raised, my response to any kind of anger was, I'm supposed to fix it. I'm supposed to fix it. I'm supposed to make it better, make it go away. And so I think it's really important for men to realize that there's a time just to sit and allow another man or a child or a woman to express their anger. And the second thing I'd like to comment on, just in general, is that I think, and Scott alluded to this when he talked about the very small percentage of men that are I wouldn't even use the term happy. I would just use the term reasonably satisfied with the work that they do. And so I think in the vast majority of men who are participants in this white system, there's a great deal of anger in them also because of what the system has done to them.
Truly, I guess.
I found it really interesting that we spent most of the discussion talking about men and talking about how men can fix their own system for women. I suspect that will never happen. I mean, it's hard for somebody in control to think of how not to be in control anymore. I mean, people in control don't often get into shared leadership. I would also slightly disagree with the statement that it's up to men to change it. And certainly in Britain, I don't really know what it's like here because Holland's really my experience in America, but feminism and feminists have a really bad name. And until coming here, there's no way I would have described myself as a feminist. I mean, that was step one to being ostracized by females as well as males. And I think females really have to look at that and look at ways that we oppress each other, look at ways that we provide opportunities for men to keep oppressing us. I mean, I do it myself, and I'm shocked when I do it. To give you one sort of petty example, I have this internalized feeling that men must be better than women at operating anything mechanical. So if ever there's a job requiring something to be chopped by the hobart, or I would always offer the man on the ship the chance to do that before offering
The women on the ship, and men think, you fool, how stupid can you be? I mean, and how often do we do that, those tiny petty things that just keep reinforcing these stereotypes?
I have sort of a half baked thought, but it keeps coming up. For the last half an hour, it keeps coming up, so I'm going to say it. The language that's been used a couple times tonight, especially Verlon, when you talked about how men get punished for stepping outside the system, is language that I've recently heard in conjunction with family systems theory, especially in a meshed family, and it sounds so much like in a meshed family. And then when Scott talked about the wimps and the underground matriarchy, we're talking about all these power struggles going on. And it's very hard to step out of a meshed system, speaking personally. And it takes a great deal of courage, and I don't think anyone really can do it alone. I think you need a lot of support for that. And Carl, I don't know, you probably know more about it than I do, but that might be an interesting discussion. And the other thing I thought of was my understanding of the importance of Jesus, and this is sort of my eclectic theology, is that he was somebody that did step out of the enmeshed family of humankind system. And he got the axe in the end, obviously. He got punished. But that's what I try to hang on to, and the importance of Jesus is that he could relate to people in new ways or different ways that were fresh and were affirming and were really scary for a lot of us.
And reading the second part of the book, I just skimmed parts. So those of you who read it totally together better. But one of the thoughts that kept occurring to me in reading the last part of the book where she suggests categories and then how we should be, how the system could work, kind of. And what kept occurring to me was, how do I know how do I know what part of what I know about me is what the culture I was raised in, or what is really what a woman, or what personally I am like, and what I can do, what I can be? And that's really an issue for me. I read one section was about time, how the white male system, everybody shows up on time, and women tend to be later, and then they went through these different categories of different kinds of people and later, and I thought, well, shoot, I kind of like to think I'm on time. And then I thought, well, maybe that's just because I like to be a part of that system. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll try being I'm making a pet example, but what can you think about, what do you know about yourself apart from how you were raised and where you were raised and all of the influences upon you? Some of you here obviously think a lot about that. Most people, it's scary to think how many people never think about it. And I'm wondering now, what can I do to make myself more aware of what I do that isn't, that is part of the problem rather than part of the solution?
I guess perhaps one of the things that came to my mind, especially when you mentioned Libby about what's Jesus' role, what can the gospel say to us in this? And I think one of the things that I've clung to recently, and it has become less of a desperate clinging and more of a clinging, and that is the grace of God in something like this, is that I realize that, you know, I think an example is perhaps the question of identity. Who really am I? And what of me is something that I've been told to be? And you go around in this chasing the tail circle of, is this me or is this not me? And there's sometimes I just kind of throw my hands and say, who knows? This is nuts. And I sort of step out of that circle and I laugh. And I equate that to grace. And in some ways, I think that is one of the ways that the gospel message comes through to me. And I will also say that's only one of the ways. I think there are probably other ways too. But for me personally, when I get caught in a bind or in mobilization, and I get a glimmer of being aware of it, the breaking through of that is one way for me to understand one means of not becoming immobilized, not becoming confused, not becoming enmeshed, is to laugh. And somehow a breaking, a rending, a tearing, not to destroy, but to keep from, stymieing. I find that as a way of grace. I find that as a means of grace. And I also find that even life is sour.
Also, to do what you want, you know, do what you want, and if you want to change it, change it. If you want to ask some people about it, ask them what. You know, I'm sure if you walk up to, you know, a man or a person of color and say, in what ways have I been racist or sexist, they'll tell you. You know, and you can work on changing that. I mean, and that's the gospel too, you know, that you can be who you are and you know, and Christ can accept you. And don't be afraid to do something that's out of line, you know. A good friend of mine, he retired from the Air Force, and he told me his greatest desire was never to work for another white man again as long as he lived. Never to take another order from a white man as long as he lived. And he said, he was getting this retirement. It wasn't big money. But it was like it was enough, you know. And he said he could, you know, he could arrange his lifestyle to fit that, so he would never have to go out and work again for a white man. Never to have a white man tell him ever again what to do. And this was important to him, you know. And I would say, cling to what's important, you know, to you, no matter how bizarre it feels or seems, you know, to get a piece of yourself back, because whatever we call this system out here certainly isn't on our side. You know.
But it's kind of a loser, isn't it? Somewhat.
It seems like we're kind of closing down here. I'd like to do a Scott and, in a sense, put a comma on this conversation. Because I truly believe that, among other things, it's a matter of growth for us as individuals. And it's a matter of challenge and growth to Holden. Because Holden is not apart from a white male system here, too. And what do we do here? So I just threw that gauntlet down, though.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's
for the next
great discussion tonight. Thanks. Yeah.